Setlist in association with 7Digital.
This week, Ticketmaster refunds and Mixcloud live streaming. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when, do you know, I've been getting into physical media. Have you heard of cassettes?
You and your trendy cassette revival.
It's, well, do you know, it was accidental.
What Jen Long started 5 years ago, Andy Malt is now. And I would add, at the time, Andy Malt was quite dismissive.
Oh, I know. I know. The irony is not lost.
Of Jen's cassette label and cassette day. And then here you are, late to the party, embracing the most pointless of all the physical media revivals.
Well, I've got this hi-fi set up in my dining room, which just sits there, really. But it's the hi-fi I've had for 20-odd years. And I play vinyl on it. I still buy vinyl. But it has a tape deck that I don't ever use. I don't know why. Like, I still have it set up there. And then my daughter wanted to listen to Billie Eilish. And someone bought me the cassette of her album as a present. And it was just happened that it was the most convenient way to get that up was to play it on the cassette. I was like, I like this. I might dig out some boxes of tapes, some old CDs. I've got my vinyl.
You can't put CDs into a cassette player.
No, it's got a CD player as well.
Don't be getting your physical formats confused.
No, it's all right. It's not been that long. I'm quite enjoying it. It's quite nice to be limited in what you can listen to.
Well, in my parents' garage, there are many, 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 many boxes of cassettes, which I would give you, except that I can't go there, so I can't.
You can't go there or here.
But there will be plenty of top quality, mainly 80s pop and a little bit of 90s indie that you could enjoy with the Chris Cook cassette collection.
Do you know what else?
What?
If I can find it, right? See, all that hi-fi set up, but if I can find it, and that's a big if at the moment.
You got a DAT?
No, I've got a mini disc. I'm going to plug that back into it as well.
Was it Mark Ronson that brought something out on mini disc quite recently? Sounds like the sort of thing you'd do.
It was, I think so, yeah.
So maybe we could get you a copy of that. In my big box of cassettes in my parents' garage in Cheshire, so not near you, not near me, I think there's probably also the cassettes of my original talking about pop music stint on the local radio station MFM in the, when would that be, early 1990s. Because I used to do the pop gossip slot on the Sunday morning show. And I'm assuming there are probably still recordings of that somewhere. So maybe I could bring that in on a week where we can't do a podcast.
Yeah, but weren't you about 9 when you did that?
Well, I wouldn't have been 9, would I? I guess I would have been 16. So we could fill one of our, you know, occasionally we have gap weeks, don't we? Where we don't have anything because one of us can't, I mean, one of us not available. Or something, you know, some at the moment, some weeks, not a lot's happening, is it? So maybe instead of doing a conventional set list, I'll just glue together various Chris Cook doing pop gossip on MFM in the early 90s. So that's something for everybody to look forward to. And it's all Andy Malt's fault for bringing up the cassette revival.
Well, I might even be able to find some of my old childhood radio shows. So maybe, yeah, this is something for everyone to look forward to as everything gets weirder on lockdown.
Yes. If this sounds like insane suggestions that we're currently making, please remember we're living in a moment in time where something that just sounds outrageous on a Monday is the norm by Wednesday.
Yes. I mean, if you listen to this sometime in the future, because people do go back to these, we should point out that this is recorded during the currently ongoing COVID-19 crisis.
Probably still ongoing if you're listening to this in 22 years' time.
We're currently a month into lockdown, and it is the day after Donald Trump suggested injecting yourself with disinfectant to cure yourself of COVID-19.
It's my favourite quote.
So that is how weird things have got now.
My favourite quote of the entire COVID-19 pandemic is the makers of Dettol having to put out a statement saying, please do not inject Dettol. Even though Donald Trump may have suggested that that could stop COVID-19. Hey, Can I do a plug?
You might as well. Anything's possible these days.
Because we've been having our lockdown webinars this week just gone. They've been very successful. Loads of people logging in from all over the world. I mean, if you think me being in London and you being by the sea, but within the UK is exciting.
It is.
I mean, we had people from Berlin, from Beijing, from New York, from Amsterdam, all tuning in to our lockdown webinars. And with the exception of Tech Trauma Tuesday, which we're not going to talk about, we are never going to talk about Tech Trauma Tuesday. Problem is, in the current world, moaning about having quite a stressful day with technology failing seems like a really stupid, pointless thing to do, doesn't it? Because in the wider scheme of things, the fact that I had a day of all my technology failing doesn't really matter, does it? But I have to say, by the end of the day, I did feel like I deserved everybody clapping at 8 o'clock. I mean, I wasn't going to steal the NHS's clapping on the Thursday, but they could have given me a Tuesday night round of applause for surviving all of my technology traumas. But despite all of that, our lockdown webinars have been going really well. And we've just announced another free. So if you are in lockdown and you fancy using some of that downtime to learn about trends in the music business, there are 9 webinars in the diary. You can book into individual ones or into all of them or some combination in the middle. So, they're going really well. They seem to be popular. So why don't you sign up and learn a little bit more about the business of music? Here ends the plug.
And while this is very much is a podcast about the business of music, your webinars are not what we are here to talk about this week.
Nor your cassette addiction.
No, but you've got to talk about something, haven't you?
Well, not necessarily.
Something's got to happen.
We could just go straight into the first story. Get rid of all of this idle chatter at the start. You could say,
we could do.
I'm Andy Malt. I could say, I'm Chris Cook. And you could just go, let's talk about Ticketmaster. That is an alternative format we could explore.
It is. But maybe that's something to discuss off air. Surely people love our increasingly unhinged chat ahead of getting into the nitty-gritty of our discussion.
And had we not had this intro waffle, some of our listeners may not have got the memo from Dettol to not inject disinfectants. So we've done a little bit of public service there as well with this intro.
Yes, it's important work that we're doing. Anyway, this week we are going to be discussing Mixcloud's new live streaming option and the complicated copyright questions that all these online performances people are doing at the moment raise. But first, a music fan in California has filed a class action lawsuit against Ticketmaster over allegations that it changed the terms on its refunds after the COVID-19 shutdown began. The Live Nation-owned ticketing company, however, has already denied any major change to its terms of service, and Live Nation itself has issued guidance about how refunds will be issued for its own American shows that have been cancelled or postponed.
Yes, so this is another little bit of litigation in the American courts relating to the significant challenge facing the live music industry and the ticketing companies dealing with the refunds for all of these many, 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 many cancelled and postponed shows. And obviously, we've talked about this before, mainly in the context of the StubHub litigation a few weeks ago. But I mean, no one promoter, no one live music company, no one ticketing platform is unique in this. The entire industry is having to deal with the unprecedented task of having so many shows stopping, some outright cancelling, some postponing, some we're not quite sure which one it is. And that's thrown up the challenge of, you know, does everybody just automatically get a refund? Is that a cash refund? How quickly is it paid? What does the law say about these things? What do the terms and conditions say about these things? And, you know, to be fair, while there are quite a lot of disgruntled customers out there, and possibly the communications has not been as good as it could have been, we should acknowledge it is a big challenge for everybody, including the ticketing company that everyone loves to hate, especially in America, where they're so flipping dominant, which, of course, is Live Nation's Ticketmaster.
Yeah, this is not just a Ticketmaster problem. And in some European countries where consumer rights laws tend to be a little bit more strict than in the US, companies have been asking for a bit more flexibility from governments on what they can do in terms of processing refunds, how quickly they need to process them, whether they can offer vouchers instead of money, that sort of thing.
And then, of course, when it comes to this whole refund drama, there's the big distinction between those shows that have definitely been cancelled and those shows which have been postponed, but we don't quite know when to. And that's very relevant to this Ticketmaster lawsuit that was filed in the US courts last week. So whereas most promoters around the world and most ticketing companies, if a show has been outright cancelled, then refunds are going out. Yes, as you've just said, some companies are looking to have more time to pay those refunds because having to refund everything in one go is a massive cash flow problem that could force some companies to collapse. So some people are looking for more time. And of course, the whole voucher thing. Lots of companies are offering vouchers instead of cash. The question, I suppose, is, and this varies from country to country, and sometimes in some countries from state to state or province to province, can a company force vouchers on people? But, I mean, as I say, if a show's been cancelled, then the ticket buyer needs to get their money back in some way or some form at some point, preferably before the year 2050. So on cancelled shows, it's a little bit more straightforward. But the question is, well, what about postponed shows? And this is where there is sometimes a little bit more flexibility in law and also different policies from different companies. Because I suppose if a show has been postponed, you know, are you saying to the ticket buyers, well, the show's still happening. We may not know when it's happening, or if we do know when it's happening, you may not be able to make it. But because the show is still happening, therefore you should just come to the show. Or because of postponement, are you going to offer people the option to just get their money back? And as I say, as you go around the world, consumer rights law says different things about refunds, particularly on things like postponement. And then you've got each company's policies and their terms and conditions. Although it has to be said, generally in the music industry, oblivious of what the obligations are under law, when promoters postpone shows, they usually, just as a matter of course, say to ticket buyers, if you can't make the new date, then of course you can have a refund. And I think one of the reasons why promoters generally, just as a matter of course, nearly always do that is because actually people in the live industry will tell you, when you postpone a show, the vast majority of the people who bought tickets still want to come. I mean, there would have to be a very specific reason why they couldn't make the second date. Like they had another commitment. They were getting married. I don't know. They were dead.
They were going to another show.
They were going to another show. So most people, the vast majority of people, will just use their ticket at the newly scheduled show. So therefore, you can say to your 20,000 ticket buyers, you can have a refund if you want, safe in the knowledge that the vast, vast majority of them will say you don't want a refund. So actually, you don't have to refund that much money. But because we're in unprecedented times, there's a little bit of an unknown. You know, if you start offering people automatically refunds on postponed shows, will everybody ask for the cash? Because maybe people are struggling for money at the moment, and so they'd rather get the money back now rather than go to a show in a year's time. Or maybe they have concerns about, will it be safe to start going to large-scale events at the point at which this large-scale event is now scheduled to happen? So there are various reasons why possibly a lot more people for postponed shows might want to refund this time round. And on top of that, we have one last issue, which is there are quite a lot of shows that are officially postponed, but we don't yet have new dates. And the reason for that is we simply do not know how long this COVID-19 shutdown of live entertainment is going to happen. Pretty much everybody is now agreeing that it's going to happen for a lot longer than we originally thought, and certainly a lot longer than we originally hoped. But obviously, there's still some dispute as to whether or not things will swing back into action in the autumn, or whether it will be the spring next year or autumn next year. And with all the uncertainty about how long it will be until certainly the biggest arena and stadium type shows can start again, people are nervous about setting the new dates because they don't want to have to set new dates and then new dates and then new dates and new dates. So there's lots of shows in limbo. So we have multiple things going on here, which is we don't necessarily know what the policies of any one promoter and ticketing company are. They probably don't even know at the moment. They certainly don't know what's going to happen if they offer everybody a refund. And in many cases, the postponed shows are yet to have new dates. So lots of confusion in amongst all of that. Quite a few aggrieved ticket fans. I suspect, actually, the aggrieved ticket fans are in the minority. I think a lot of people, they still want to go to the show they bought the ticket for. They like the artist who's playing at that show, and they accept that in the current climate, nothing is going to happen as efficiently as we would like. So I suspect the aggrieved customers are in the minority, but nevertheless, quite a lot of aggrieved customers being vocal about this online. And Ticketmaster, obviously in the US, such a dominant company. A lot of people love to bash Ticketmaster. Politicians in the US love to bash Ticketmaster. So there have been quite a lot of criticism of Ticketmaster in the US about the whole cancelled shows, postponed shows, refunds thing, and it being America. You don't need that many aggrieved people shouting online before an inevitable lawsuit arrives on the table.
Yes, and it's Ticketmaster's policy on postponed shows that is at the heart of this new class action lawsuit, which has been filed by a guy called Derek Hansen. In February, he says he bought tickets via the Ticketmaster website for two Rage Against the Machine shows that were due to take place last week. Those shows obviously were postponed as a result of the COVID-19 shutdown. But, he goes on to say, when he bought those tickets, the relevant page on the Ticketmaster website stated that refunds would be available if the event was postponed, rescheduled, or cancelled. However, he says now the ticketing firm has, I quote, retroactively changed their refund policies so that visitors to the same webpage were redirected to a new page that said only that refunds were available for cancellations. In other words, the lawsuit goes on, defendants now identifies cancellation as the only basis for getting a refund. Refunds are no longer being offered for postponed shows, which are currently postponed indefinitely, or for rescheduled shows, even if ticket holders can't make the new date. Ticketmaster's policy now states that if the event was moved, postponed, or rescheduled, the promoter or venue may set refund limitations.
Now, as we said, before this lawsuit was filed, there had been quite a lot of criticism of Ticketmaster over refunds on the social networks, in some of the American press, and some politicians in Washington, mainly the politicians who love criticising Ticketmaster, had criticised Ticketmaster on this. What that meant was, by the time this lawsuit was filed with the court, we'd already had some statements of one form or another from Ticketmaster. So first of all, a spokesperson for the ticketing company had told various media that it hadn't actually changed its policy on refunds for postponed shows. It had simply clarified its policy by changing some of the wording on its website. Now, that might be sneaky semantics, I don't know. But what they were basically saying was, it has always been our policy that ultimately we're just the agent that sells the tickets. It's for the promoter of the show to decide what the deal is on refunds on postponed shows. That has always been our policy, says Ticketmaster, and we've just tweaked the text on our website to better reflect that. Although that statement from Ticketmaster still posed the question, well, will this guy be able to get a refund on his postponed show? Are you just passing the buck? What will be the deal? Shortly after that, the president of Ticketmaster in the US, a guy called Jared Smith, he responded to those politicians in Washington who had been criticizing his company on this. And in his letter back to those politicians, he said, "Let me reiterate, neither our clients," by which he means the promoters of the show, "nor Ticketmaster intend to withhold refunds on postponed shows. In fact, as of today," the today being the day when he wrote this letter, "both Live Nation Entertainment and AEG Live, two of our largest event organisers, have announced they will begin to provide refunds on a rolling basis for all events impacted by COVID-19, which includes postponed shows as well as cancelled shows." Obviously, the slight weird thing there with the way the live industry works, that he's talking about Live Nation there as a client, which they are, but they're also the owner of the company. The other client's AEG, Live Nation's fiercest competitor. Yeah, the live industry in the US is kind of weird.
Now, off the record, other Live Nation and Ticketmaster execs have been, well, critical of their critics, although off the record. But they have argued that they've been working flat out to try to deal with what is an unprecedented situation. They've stressed that for each postponed show, they always have to discuss things with the promoters, the venues, the booking agents, the artist managers, and the artists themselves to work out what the best plan of action is going to be. And doing that takes time. And when you're doing that for all of your shows, it's going to take even longer. So while some people have been suggesting that them not coming forward with an absolute answer on all refunds is a bit ominous, they're arguing off the record again that it just takes a long time to sort this and they will sort it.
And of course, there's that whole thing, isn't there, that in this COVID era that we're living in, 2 days seems like a really long time. In the wider scheme of things, it hasn't been that long a time. It's just that everything at the moment feels like it's dragging on for months and months. In terms of what the announcements that Live Nation and AEG had made just before this lawsuit was filed, basically, they are both offering almost automatic refunds on cancelled shows. I say almost because Live Nation are also offering to their customers the option to get a voucher that's worth 150% of the original ticket price. Quite a few promoters around the world are trying to persuade people to take the vouchers, because even if ultimately you're giving the customer more money on the voucher, it helps with cash flow if you can put that off for 6 months or 12 months rather than paying them now. So Live Nation is running a voucher scheme. So that means, whereas I think AEG, this is in the US, obviously these are global companies, but the statements they put out were America-centric, AEG is just refunding everybody, so you don't even have to do anything. It's just the money will reappear in your bank account. Whereas with Live Nation, because they have this voucher scheme, emails will go out and then people have to pick, I want a refund or I want a voucher. I think there's also the option to donate the money from the ticket to charity or something like that. When it comes to postponed shows, what both companies are saying is as soon as new dates are announced, emails will go out, and then the ticket buyer will have a 30-day window when they can either accept the ticket for the new show or request a refund, or in the case of Live Nation, request 150%. I think it's up to 150%. Don't quite know how that works. Voucher. So that's what Live Nation and AEG have announced in the US. Of course, they are not the only promoters putting on shows. They're not the only promoters dealing with cancelled and postponed shows, although it has to be said, when you put Live Nation and AEG together, that will be a significant number of the shows on the Ticketmaster platform. I think the Rage Against the Machine shows were AEG promoted. So quite a lot of the shows will be covered just by those two big companies because they're so bloody big, especially in the US. But of course, there are plenty of other smaller and independent and regional promoters in America. And because Ticketmaster is basically saying when it comes to postponements, it's up to the promoter, then on that, there is still a little bit of ambiguity about what would happen. Plus, of course, even with Live Nation and AEG, where a show has been postponed but ultimately is still in limbo because of no new dates yet, well, on those shows, for the time being at least, refunds will not be available.
Now, the lawyer working on this case, Marie McCrary, did acknowledge that some statements have been made by Ticketmaster and Live Nation in the run-up to this lawsuit being filed, but said there were still concerns that meant this lawsuit should go ahead. She said, "We remain concerned that for rescheduled events, Ticketmaster is still leaving the refund decision to the organisers of each event. In addition, when events are postponed indefinitely without any new date set, refunds are being denied. Ticketmaster needs to offer refunds for all such events."
So it remains to be seen as this lawsuit goes through the motions. It may be by the time a judge is actually considering the allegations contained within it that Ticketmaster has issued enough statements that most of it, if not all of it, is now irrelevant. But obviously there's this case, there is that StubHub case that we talked about a few weeks ago. So the second ticketing website, StubHub, has also been sued about its policies and allegations that it has changed its policies when it comes to refunds on cancelled shows. Now, both of those cases could potentially almost be irrelevant by the time they get some proper court time, but it will be interesting to see how those cases progress, whether any other lawsuits are filed on this issue, and rest assured, we will be following it all as it moves forward.
And finally this week, Mixcloud has fast-tracked the launch of a new live streaming option that it has been developing behind the scenes, allowing people to live stream both audio and video on its platform. Its aim with this is to address both monetization and copyright questions raised by the sudden spike in music being broadcast online.
Yes, of course, since the COVID-19 shutdown began, many artists have been firing up the various live streaming apps and platforms that are there on the internet in order to sing some songs and connect with their fan base, given that they're now not able to do that in the real world, for the time being at least. And I think we've talked about this before on Setlist. It's interesting as all of that has been happening. I think initially it was about trying to stay connected. Maybe there was a little element of, you know, trying to keep the fan base engaged. But, you know, for those artists who have seen significant fall in income as a result of COVID-19 shutdown, whether that's because they predominantly rely on ticket revenues and the fees from live shows and that revenue streams be cut off overnight, or they do lots of studio work and the studios are shut, whatever. Obviously, there is that question of, you know, for the artists who are struggling financially at the moment, could this increase in live streaming and the accompanying interest from audiences to watch live streams, could we monetize that? And obviously, there are various ways that you can monetize live streaming. There always have been. And all of the live streams that have been occurring every single day since the shutdown began, some people have been trying to use that to generate income, either by using a platform that allows you to charge a ticket fee, or by having some sort of donation system running alongside it, or by using the live stream to try and sell merchandise or whatever. And it's been really interesting to watch the different approaches people have taken, the different platforms that people have taken, whether or not people are charging, are they charging, and then sort of behind the scenes talking to artists and saying, well, did you make any decent money? And of course, people like us are interested in asking the question, is this a temporary blip during lockdown, or could this be the thing that takes live streaming, which isn't new, but which had never really taken off in a mainstream way, a big way. I mean, obviously, Boiler Room probably has had the most success in this space up till now. But could it be that all of this makes live streaming a much bigger part of the music industry long term? And does that become a useful extra revenue stream for artists, not just during the COVID-19 pandemic, but also in the long term down the line? But beyond the questions around whether or not live streaming can be monetized, and actually this other question becomes even bigger once live streams are being monetized, which is, for us copyright geeks, how are these live streams being licensed from a copyright perspective? If recordings are being featured in the stream, how are those recordings being licensed from the label and the artists who made them? But more importantly, because this applies to every single live stream that features music, what about the song rights? Particularly as often the songwriters, the people who are the beneficiaries of the song rights, are not involved in the live stream. So yeah, the sudden peak in live streaming has brought a whole load of questions about the copyright implications and the licensing implications of live streams to the fore.
Yeah, you'd think that, as you said, I mean, live streaming has been around for a while, but it's not really been that big a business to date. And so licensing these services has been quite low down the music industry's list of priorities because it just hasn't been that important. And I think that, as I say, there are various services that offer explicit live streaming services or maybe not so explicit, but something like, say, Mixlr, which is for online broadcasting, as I understand it, it very much says you can broadcast live over our platform, but if you're broadcasting any sort of copyrighted music on there, you have to have a broadcast license to do that. So there's that angle to it. More than things like that, though, I think obviously people are trying to reach their audience with this, and so they're turning more to platforms like Instagram and Facebook and things like that in order to do live broadcasts on lockdown. And that is where things get, I mean, more confusing, because they are licensed platforms. It's just that when it comes to live streaming stuff, it often turns out actually they're not.
Yeah, it's understandable that artists and other people who are sort of organising these live performances, live streaming, it's excusable for them to assume that platforms like YouTube and Facebook and Instagram that have licensing deals with the music industry, much talked about licensing deals in the music industry, well, they must be covered for live streaming. But quite often when you delve into the licenses that these services have, even those companies that do have relationships with the music industry versus those technologies that don't have any relationships, often live streaming isn't technically covered. And I mean, the minute we have live streams, there are a bunch of sort of academic copyright questions to be asked, which will probably be one of the reasons why these licensing deals weren't all done 5 years ago. Things like, obviously, we can break copyright down into a number of different of what we call the different controls of the copyright. So there's the copying element and the communication element and the making available element and the performance element. And whenever a new way of delivering content comes along, one of the questions is, well, which elements of the copyright are being exploited? Is it the same as what's being exploited when a Spotify stream is streamed? Or is it different when it's a live stream? Is it now a performance, not a communication? And while you might think that's mere semantics, who the hell cares? Of course, because the way the music industry is organised, you need to know which bits of the copyright are being exploited, because it has an impact on who you need a licence from and what the terms of that licence will be. So it is actually quite a complicated area. The law firm Reed Smith, very early into the COVID-19 shutdown, when the sort of flurry of big artists live streaming first started to kick off, they actually very quickly put together quite an interesting guide on this. Some answers in that guide, but as with all these sort of digital licensing things, also quite a lot of questions that don't really have any answers. So if you're really interested in this from a nerdy copyright law perspective, maybe we'll put a link to that guide in the setlist notes and you should go and read that. But we're here today to talk about something positive rather than all of the usual digital licensing crap. And that is that Mixcloud, with their new live streaming option, have potentially come up with a good solution for both the monetization question and the copyright question, because the wider Mixcloud platform already comes with monetization tools and with licenses from the music industry.
So yeah, this new service is called Mixcloud Live. The company says that it's the first music-focused solution to enable audio creators to live stream and generate income, all via a legal and licensed platform. Mixcloud co-founder Nico Perez added that, "We are very focused on helping creators generate more income directly from their fans via their live streams. and that we hope that Mixcloud Live brings a little more fun and maybe some dancing into your home, particularly at this time when the world is socially distant and we all need to feel a bit closer.
It's worth adding that not only is this Mixcloud moving into live streaming for the first time, it's also Mixcloud moving into video streaming for the first time. It's possible that some of our listeners don't really know what Mixcloud is, and it is an audio sharing platform. So in some ways there are parallels with SoundCloud, except that the big difference between Mixcloud and lots of the other audio content sharing platforms is that Mixcloud has never been about uploading single tracks. The clue's kind of in the name. It began with people uploading mixes, but then people started also uploading sort of homemade radio shows, or indeed quite a lot of radio stations started putting their own radio shows up there. And then with the podcast boom, quite a lot of podcasters put their stuff up on Mixcloud. And its big USP to date has been that from the off, it has had licenses from the music industry. Now, like any company trying to get licenses from the music industry, being completely globally licensed is a challenge. And when it launched here in the UK, initially it did so with Collecting Society licenses, blanket licenses from PRS on the song side and PPL on the recording side, whereas it has subsequently started to do direct deals on the recording side. But Mixcloud has been going quite a long time and has been very focused on the licensing from the off. That has always been its USP. So that's why it's able to seemingly start to address the licensing issues around live streaming. But as I say, the interesting thing is that this is not just live audio streaming, which you might have expected from an audio platform. There is video as part of the mix as well. And then the monetization comes from the fact that it was last year, I think, wasn't it, that Mixcloud added what it calls Mixcloud Select.
Yep.
Which is a functionality which allows individual channel owners to charge a subscription fee. So in addition to there being a Mixcloud platform-wide subscription offer, individual channel owners can charge a subscription. That's Mixcloud Select, and that is being integrated with this new live streaming service so that we have a live streaming option that A, has a whole bunch of the licensing stuff sorted and some monetization options from the off. And this new live streaming functionality, Mixcloud was already developing it pre-COVID-19 shutdown, but obviously having seen the sudden uplift in live streaming since everyone went into lockdown, and presumably aware of the spin-off conversations about how the hell do you monetize live streaming, what about all the licensing challenges, they've fast-tracked it and put it live, I think technically in beta, but I have seen a few people on social media, a few artists and DJs and producers already testing it. So an interesting addition to the Mixcloud platform, and a very relevant, timely one at that.
But that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. Do remember to subscribe, rate, review, email us. This is just a punchy list this week. setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk if you want to email us. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.